So today I'm going to discuss the. I plan to discuss the general structure of perturbation theory, and in particular its formulation in terms of generating functional. So that's something that I think you have seen already, or you have been introduced to generating functionals in or generating functions in the quantum theory course, and maybe also in QFT1. No, okay. So I'm going to introduce. So that would be general structure of perturbation theory. Going to introduce generating functions and functionals. I'm going to define what are connected and irreducible functions. And if time, I start to discuss the important concept of quantum effective action, which is going to be one of the an important example of generating functional. OK, so before doing that, maybe I'll show, since I have some well-prepared slides, let me recall what we did last time and the typical structure of perturbation theory in the case of the 5-4 theory. So I'm still dealing with the 5-4 theory. So thank you. So since I'm going to discuss some higher order diagram, it's better to have a picture, but you don't need to copy all of them. Okay, so remember, we start from the 5-4 theory, and in the interacting 5-4 theory, these are the diagram we discussed on Friday. First, for the just the diagram which appears in the perturbative expansion of the partition function. So the basically the functional integral. They are called vacuum diagram because they allow to compute the quantum vacuum energy, taking into account the quantum fluctuation of the vacuum. Okay, so the first diagram, which contains just one vertex, so that's the leaning order in G, is proportional to this expectation value of phi 4 at one point, and therefore is given by this diagram where you have two propagators connected at the same point with a factor 1 over 8. That's counting factors. N is the number of external legs, so since the diagrams have no external legs, it's n equals 0. This is order 2, so in order 2, we derived that there were three different diagrams, and out of those diagrams, those ones are connected. This one is disconnected, therefore the Feynman amplitude or Feynman integral associated to this diagram is the square of this one. But this one are non-trivial. And if one goes on, I'll come back to that maybe later. So now if we are interested in the two-point function, the two-point diagram with two external vertices, well, this is just a propagator. When you introduce that first order in perturbation theory, you have those two diagrams, and again, this diagram is connected, this diagram is disconnected. So its amplitude of this diagram times the amplitude of this diagram. If you go further, something that I've not been doing, but that's an exercise that maybe you have done already, at order 2 in perturbation theory, you have 7 different kinds of diagrams, but because you need 2 vertices, but out of those 7 diagrams, different diagrams, only 3 of them are connected. Therefore, they are new. You don't know them from the previous calculation. You have this one, and this one. Okay? with some combinatorial factor, 1,4, 1,4, 1,6. And if you go now to the four-point diagram, of course, at leading at order zero in perturbation theory, this is, you have three diagrams which are given by the three term of the three pairings of the Vick theorem. This one, this one, this one. If you go to first order in perturbation theory, you have to insert 1,5,4, and if you are a bit careful, you see that you have then a bunch of possible pairings, so a bunch of possible coefficients, but you can check that out of all those ones, all these are just obtained from what you got for the vacuum diagram and the two-point function, and only this one is new. And this one is a connected diagram. All the other ones are disconnected diagram, which you obtain from the Feynman rule of the other, okay? So, now if you, and then you can go on. So now I'm going to just show you briefly, give a snapshot of what are the connected diagram and go a bit further. So now I restrict myself to connected vacuum, so connected diagram. So here are the connected diagram from the vacuum. So there is this one, there is this one, there is this one, and I'll explain later what is this diagram, which is of order zero in G. I'm going to explain that later. It's a circle with no vertex, but it's convenient to introduce it, but I'm just going to explain what it is later. And for the two-point function, so this is the propagator, this is the first order, these are the second order. And so this is a connected vacuum diagram. And out of that, now if you look at the diagram of the two-point function, you notice something, it's just combinatorics and geometry at that level. The two-point function is built out of some peculiar sub-diagram, this one, this kind of just bubble closed, this one, or this one, which are chained by propagator. So it's a chain of propagator with diagram, and these diagrams have the peculiarity that they are irreducible. If you cut a line, they stay connected. So remember, if you cut a line here, if you remove this line, this diagram, this sub-diagram, is just one vertex which is connected. If you cut any of those, if you remove any of those lines, those two vertices stay connected. You see? While, of course, if you cut this line here, this diagram becomes disconnected. Or if you cut this line here, this external vertex is disconnected from this internal vertex. Okay. So, again, now, for the four-point function, these are the diagram that I drew on the last, the previous slide. These are the diagram of the four-point function. But if you go to the connected diagram, here you have the connected. So let me just now consider the connected diagram of the four-point function, and then you can work a bit more. This is the connected diagram at first order for the four-point function. And these are the possible connected diagram at second order. And you can obtain them either by crafting a bubble on one of the line of this one, or you can connect in a new non-trivial way the two internal vertices, and you get basically this kind of bubble diagram where you have two vertices connected by two internal lines. And then you see that those diagrams are different simply because it's different pairs of external vertices which are connected to this vertex and this vertex. So topologically they are the same, but simply it's not the same diagram, the same external vertices which are connected to the internal vertices. So we have three of them. Okay, and now if you think about whether there are irreducible parts, subdiagrams in this diagram, you are in fact led to consider that the single vertex is irreducible because you have no line that you can cut. Here you have, this is an irreducible part and this is an irreducible part. And is in those three new diagrams, here is the irreducible part. Because if you cut, if you remove this line, those two internal vertices stays connected by the other line. Okay. And okay, so the game goes on. So now let's briefly discuss the six-point function. We have not discussed the six-point function yet, but if you apply Wick's theorem to compute the six-point function, you realize that the first connected non-trivial diagram appears at order G2, because in order to connect six external points in a connected way by four valent vertices, you need two vertices. Okay? And then you get this kind of double cross where you connect, you have two internal vertices, yet they are connected by just one propagator, one line, and then it remains six way lines to connect, and so you can connect the external vertices to those six free lines, and then you have a bunch of way to do that by just permuting the indices of the external. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but you can have 2, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, which is topologically, well, this is topologically the same, but if you interpret 1 and 6, this will not be the same diagram. You see. Okay. Now, if you go to next order in perturbation theory, so it's a term of order G cube because you have three vertices, internal vertices. You can of course craft bubbles on the lines of this diagram. These are those kind of things, but you can also insert a bubble to connect two internal vertices. You get this kind of diagram. Again, it's an all possible way of labeling the external vertices. And then you have another diagram, which is brand new because it's not obtained from previous parts, which is this triangle diagram, where you have three vertices, internal vertices, connected together by three internal lines, and you have six external lines. Okay, so you can work out what are the symmetry factor for this diagram. And again, if you think about what are the irreducible subpart of this diagram, here there are just two internal vertices. Here you have two internal vertices and one bubble. Here you have one internal vertices and this bubble. And here, the new irreducible part is a triangle. Okay, because if you cut this, it stays connected. Okay. So, and finally, but I think you have seen that very briefly with Pedro in the statistical mechanical course. If you go back to why, for instance, this diagram has a factor 1/8, you can think about the origin of the combinatorial factor in a diagram by stating that when you apply the Wick theorem, you start with a bunch of internal vertices with four free legs, and you have to connect those legs in all possible ways into, well, each other for internal lines, and with the free legs available for the external vertices. So in order to count everything, and be careful, this is in French, I'm sorry. Étiquetage means labeling. So the best way is to think about having a labeling of the legs of each internal vertex from 1 to 4. Okay, but so each line initially is labeled by one label from 1 to 4 and the label of the internal vertex. Okay. And then when you apply the Fick theorem, for instance, if you want to compute this diagram, of course, since you have three different ways to connect those, it means that if you keep the labeling, you have three. This diagram can be labeled. If you label the external legs of the vertices, it can be labeled in three different ways. But these diagrams have the same amplitude. They gave the same number. So there is no point in keeping the labeling. So if you remove the labeling, you get a factor of 3. And so this vertex in the Feynman rules is associated with the factor g divided by factorial 4. So the factor associated to this diagram is 3, the number of equivalent labeling, divided by factorial 4, which is 1/8. So this factor is a number of inequivalent labeling of the legs associated to the internal vertices for a given graph G. So I take this graph. I consider the number of inequivalent labeling of the graph, and I divide by a factor, which is in fact here, the total number of possible labelings. Here it's factorial 4, because we have only one vertex. If I had two vertices, it would be 1/2 times 1/4 squared, because I have two possible labeling for the vertices and factorial 4 possible labeling for each of the vertices of the legs of the vertices. So we have a number of inequivalent labelings of a graph divided by the total number of labelings, which is of course 1/4 the number of equivalent labelings of the given graph G. And there is a theorem of group theory which states that this is just the order of the symmetry group of the graph G. So think about this graph and think about all the possible transformation where you change the labelings. You see, you have all the possible labelings of a given graph, and you can make permutation of the labelings, for instance. So you have a transformation, you have a permutation here. Tuck, 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 tuck. Okay. And think about what are the possible labelings which give the same graph. It's a subgroup of the group of permutation of labelings. So to each given graph, we have a symmetry group of permutations of labelings. In this case, it's going to be the group of permutation that's called sigma 4, which has factorial 4 elements. Okay. Now think, so this symmetry group, let me call it G of, it's a bad expression, so G of the graph. Now you have a subgroup, H of the graph. It's G, because it doesn't depend on the graph. You have a subgroup E of the graph, which is a subgroup, it's a subgroup of G, which is subgroup of permutations, which keeps the graph. So for instance, it means that here, if I permute 1 and 2, I get the same. If I permute 1 and 3, I get this. So the permutation 1, 2 and the permutation 1, 3 are different. So the symmetry group G of the graph is G quotiented by H graph, and its number of elements is precisely the total number of labelings divided by the number of inequivalent labelings. So you have a group theory interpretation on this factor 1/8. Okay. So this is detailed a bit in my notes, but I wanted to mention that, but because it's important. Okay, I'm going a bit fast, but that's important to know that this exists. Okay, so now let me go back to the concept of, of irreducible diagrams. We have seen that, in fact, the Feynman diagrams for the connected function are built out of irreducible parts, which are connected by lines. So one useful object is consider the sum of irreducible diagrams. So you, instead of considering all possible diagrams with a given number of external points, or the sum over all the diagrams which are connected with a fixed number of external points, you may consider the sum, the contribution of the diagram which are irreducible. And here I'm going to give just an example. Okay. Well, it turns out that for phi to the 4, all diagrams, all vacuum diagrams, if they are connected, they are irreducible. So I can define, you know, a contribution. That's just a symbol, this big capital gamma with index 0, exponent 0, is just the sum over the irreducible diagrams of the theory. And with just, I have changed the sign. So it's plus g instead of minus g. And that's, I'm going to explain the contribution of this later, added. Now, for the irreducible two-point function, there is a subtlety. We have seen that this diagram is irreducible. We have seen that this diagram is irreducible. We have seen that this diagram is irreducible. But of course, you have to remove the external legs because they are not irreducible. So one trick to remove the irreducible legs is just to define something which is just the contribution of an amputated legs. So removing the legs here means that instead of having, so for the contribution of the propagator between this point, let's call it z and let's call it x, instead of being the usual propagator, you take it to be a delta function in position space or one in momentum space. So I enforce that this point here coincides with this one. Okay? If I do that, of course, the contribution of this line reduces to a trivial factor. So you can state that the contribution of this irreducible diagram with those legs amputated, because you have removed the contribution of them, is just a contribution of this Feynman diagram. Okay, so this is a definition of a contribution of an amputated legs. The leg is still there, but you just give it a factor one instead of a propagator. Okay, and this works everywhere except for the original propagator, because the original propagator has one leg coming out of this diagram, one leg coming out of this diagram, and according to this kind of formal rules, you should amputate it here and here. So you should amputate it twice. And if you amputate it twice, it means that you take the propagator and you multiply it by the inverse of the propagator twice. But the inverse of the propagator is the kernel of the operator minus Laplacian plus m squared, whose Fourier transform is p squared plus m squared. So the contribution of these amputated legs is taken to be, that's again a definition, just p squared plus m squared in momentum space, instead of being 1 over p squared plus m squared for an ordinary propagator. Okay, so that's just convenient rules which allows to define something which is called the contribution of irreducible diagram. And if you think about it, this is a sum of the irreducible diagram that appears in the four-point function. So first you have the vertex, which corresponds to the vertex with amputated legs. Second, we have these bubbles with four amputated legs. And if you go further at order three vertices, you get this diagram, which is irreducible if you amputate the external legs, and this diagram, plus permutation of the external labels of the external vertices. So you have two different non-trivial irreducible diagram for the four-point function, this one and this one. And I don't remember if I draw the diagram for the six-point function. Yes, I did. If you walk a bit, that's an exercise. The first irreducible diagram in the perturbative expansion of the six-point function we have seen is a triangle. So it's this diagram where you amputate or cut the external legs, so you get the vertex. And if you go further, there are three different diagrams with four internal vertices which are irreducible. You have this one, it's a square where it's here you have two, and here you have a bubble. Here you have a triangle crafted to a bubble with two lines. And here you have a square with a diagonal. Let me see. So, this, if you are following, if I'm not going too fast, you start to see the logic of that. And you see in particular that the number of irreducible diagrams is much smaller than the number of connected diagrams, which is much smaller than the number of diagrams. And they contain the core of what you are interested in. When one has to compute the Feynman amplitudes, so the physical quantities associated to a Feynman diagram, in fact, once you know the Feynman amplitude associated to these objects, you can easily reconstruct the amplitude associated to correlation functions. So these are objects which are interesting to study in their own, both because they are simpler, and as we shall see, because they correspond also to some important physical quantity. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. We spend a couple of minutes in order to... Okay, thank you. So now let's go back to the analytics of that. Okay, so correlation functions. What are and generating functions? So what are correlation functions? So so we have seen that, so we are in the 5-4 theory. Well, again, I'm going to walk in the Euclidean space-time, because then I get rid of the, I don't have to care about the high factor, but what's important, it's going to be the same. So the action, the Euclidean action for phi, for the field configuration is d dx, 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi plus g divided by factorial 4 phi to the 4. I omit the E is omitted for simplicity. And we have seen that the partition function, so the basic object, the functional integral that we want to compute in order to define correlation function, is this partition function, which is formally defined as a functional integral of a field configuration of exponential of minus 1 over h bar times the action. So that's what we want to compute. Okay. So we can define the generating functional for correlation function by just modifying this object by adding a source term. So let's add a source term here. So I'm going to explain what we are doing here. So I add a function g of x, which is a classical source term. So it's a function from RD to R, let's say. It's a real classical source term. Okay. Of course, phi is a random variable because you integrate over it. So it's a class, it's a quantum. It's a quantum object because you integrate over it. Okay, and g phi means simply it's a shortened notation for the integral over space-time of g of x phi of x. It makes notation shorter. So if instead of computing the functional integral, you know, the integral over phi exponential of the action, if you had minus g of phi, this becomes a function. If you know how to compute it, it becomes a function of the function g. So this is a function, so it's a functional of the source term g, which is itself a function. Okay. So this is a very, you know, very formal object, but that's the definition. Okay. And this object is called the generating functional or generating function for the correlation function. Okay, for this object here. Okay. Why is it so? It's simply because if you formally expand this in power of g, you see, what you recover is just the usual functional integral where you insert some phi. So you can rewrite, if you like, g. So let me rewrite this g of z divided by z of zero. Zero is a term with no source term. So this is just, let me expand this in powers of g. I get sum from n equals zero to infinity of h bar minus n divided by factorial n times, and then I have g phi to the power, factor g phi to the power n in the functional integral, okay? And the factor g phi to the power n means a multiple integral over dx, well, dz1 up to dzn. I should have written this z, if you prefer, to be fully consistent. G of z1 up to g of zn. And then we have, inside the functional integral, integral d phi exponential minus the actions times phi of z1 up to phi of zn. And that's divided by the partition function. So what we get is just the expectation value of phi of z1 f to phi of zn in the interacting theory. So this is a correlation function. Okay. Of course, warning, when doing that, I have make the interversion between the sum, the series expansion of this, and the functional integral. So the same caveat that I gave for perturbation theory applies. But formally, so in perturbation theory, so this is valid as a formal series in G. Okay. And this is the source, the functional with the source term, and this is the source on all, the functional when G is equal to zero. Okay. So knowing G, Z of G, amounts to knowing to know all the correlation function. Or in other words, this object, this functional Z of G, is a convenient way. If you compute this, you deal at once with all the correlation function. So it's both as a physical interpretation, that's what happens when you change the action by adding a term like that, and G corresponds to some kind of external. So G is like, is similar to some external field, classical field, hence the name source. Okay, but it's a source of the correlation function. So if we know how to manipulate this, we manipulate all the correlation function at once. Okay. Good. Okay. Or if you prefer, this is equivalent to state that if you take Z of G and take its functional derivative with respect to the source term, you can write that the correlation function phi of z1, phi of zn is just, well, up to h bar. So it's h bar to the power n times the functional derivative with respect to the source term at point z1 times the functional derivative with g to the zn of z of g. Okay. But if you keep these terms, of course, you take the functional derivative and then you set g equals zero and you normalize this by z of g at g equals zero. So this is the numerator, this is the denominator. So this is equivalent to state that by functional differentiation, by this is a functional derivative of this object with respect to the value of a function at g of z. Okay? And I presume you have seen the concept of functional derivative in the, I think, in the first course about functional calculus. And this, of course, comes just from the fact that the functional derivative of g phi, g of z, of g times phi, is just phi of z. That's a very definition of a functional derivative, basically. If you know that, you know everything about functional derivative. But for a lot of mathematical subtlety. For instance, the fact that in general, a functional derivative of a functional is a distribution and not a function. But okay. So you can think of Z of G as an object containing all the correlation function, or as an object so that when you take its functional derivative and divide by the thing, then you obtain the correlation functions. Okay. And this h bar comes just for the normalization, the fact that we divide the g phi by h bar. That's again just a normalization for the definition of the source term, but it turns out to be convenient. Okay. So, this is the first object we have defined, the generating function for the correlation functions. So now, in fact, what turns out to be why this is important, that's because now, consider a second object. So this is the first object, one. Function one. Let's consider the second function, two, which is going to be the generating function for connected diagrams. Okay. Well, in order to construct an object giving you, by the same formula, not the correlation function, but the part of a correlation function given only by the sum of a connected diagram, it's very simple in this language, because what you just have to take is, let me consider the following object, a new functional of the source term function that I'm going to call W, that's one of the possible notation, and let me define it as just h bar times the logarithm of z of g. Okay? Well, this h bar, again, is just for convenience. Okay? Then, with a bit of work, you can check that this is going to be just, again, you can expand it in powers of G, of the source term G. And it turns out that first there is an h bar to the power n minus 1, because you multiply by h1 here. You again get a factorial n. Again, you get your dz1 up to dzn, g of z1, g of zn. But what you get here is a bit complicated, you know, combination of correlation functions. But it turns out that what this is just an object phi of z1, phi of zn, which I'm going to call the connected correlation function. And this object, phi of z1, phi of zn, connected, which you can also write as W of z1, zn, because that's a function of the external point z1, zn, is just given by the sum of a connected diagrams. And then you have, let's call them C or G, but the diagram are connected, of the combinatorial factor of G, the amplitudes IG of Z1, Zn, that's the Feynman amplitudes, Feynman amplitudes. Here you have a correlation function. Then you have factor G and a factor of H bar with a number of vertices and the proper definition of h bar, which is going to be the same than one but for one. Okay, so it's just given by the sum of Feynman connected diagram. Okay, and for instance, If you consider what is phi of z1, phi of z2 connected, this is just the ordinary phi of z1. Oh, I see. This is phi of z1, phi of z2. Because the two-point function is always connected. But the four-point function, phi of z2, phi of z3, phi of z4, but let me invert. Four-point diagram can be written as two-point diagrams, plus things like that, object like that, plus, and then a connected diagram like that, plus vacuum diagrams. Okay. And therefore, when you consider the expectation value of this object, it's a combination of phi of z1, phi of z2 times phi of z3, phi of z4, which are equivalent to the connected diagram, plus plus two other terms, plus the sum of those diagrams, which gives a connected four-point function. Okay, and etc. Okay, and to prove that W of G defined by this log of Z corresponds to the Feynman diagram can be easily proven by showing simply that you can invert that and write that Z of G is exponential of 1 over h bar W of G. Okay, that's equivalent to my definition. And if W of G, assume that W of G is a sum of the contribution of connected diagrams and expand the exponential, what you get is that this is 1, plus 1 over h bar W of G, plus 1 over h bar squared, 1 half W of G squared, plus etc. So this that we know is the sum of the contribution of all the diagram. It's 1, which is the contribution of the diagram, which is 0, nothing, empty diagram, if you like. This is the sum of the connected diagram. This is a product of sum of connected diagram. So this is this plus this in our case, etc. And the next term will be given, give the diagrams which are made out of three connected components, etc. So that's the simplest way to prove this. So this is second, the second important object.
Sorry.
Yes.
Could I just ask about the factors of h bar?
What?
The factors of h bar in your expression for w. Why is it n minus 1 and not h bar to the 1 minus n?
I'm sorry. I'm sure I understand your question.
In the expression for w.
Yes.
The factor of h bar is h bar to the power of n minus 1. But I'm wondering.
That's
1 and not 1 minus.
That's because the correlation function here have a factor h bar minus n. But remember that in this definition, you have other factor of h bar. So I think it's consistent with this. But take this as a choice. It's just as a definition. It's a convenient definition. OK? Let me give an example. For instance, if you consider the correlation function of you mean you are, I've wrote a minus 1. I'm sorry. This is my, I see. I'm sorry. This was a typo in my mind, at least in a glitch in my mind. That's minus 1 plus, yeah, that's what, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, of course, it's minus n from here, and it's plus one because I added an h bar. Yeah, and it works out because, for instance, if you consider in this definition, what is leading order W of Z1, Z2, this is going to be h bar minus 2 plus 1 times the propagator, phi of Z1, phi of Z2, which is h bar minus 1 times h bar divided by p squared plus m squared if you go to Fourier transform. So they coincide. So this h bar, if, for instance, in order to have the leading coefficient here for the two-point function to have no h bar, that's the choice. This h bar is notation, which means that at leading order, the connected two-point function is just this plus, so it's minus g times this diagram, for instance, which is connected. But this is going to have no h bar, and this is going to have an h bar to the power 1, etc. Okay. So that's why this normalization is usually chosen. Okay. Yes. Well, that's what I wrote in my notes. So I just didn't. Okay. So now let me introduce the third generating function, and which is going to be a bit more subtle. No, it's not working. Ah. Well, there are two of them that are not working now. Okay. Ah, yes. No, that's okay. Sorry. I get lost. Okay, so this was my third blackboard. This was my fourth blackboard. I hope I should have used the other one. Okay, anyway. Okay, let's. Okay, so I'm going to introduce a new functional, a function generating function 3, which is called the effective action. Effective quantum action. And this functional will not be a function of G, it's going to be what's called the Legendre transform of W of G. Okay? And Legendre transform are a mathematical transform which is very much used in physics. Mass too, also, but because it allows you to express the physical property of an object not in terms of its source term, but in terms of the response of the field of the system to the source term. So here you have a system. So W of G contains depends on some external field, if you want, because G plays a role of an external field coupled to the quantum field. And this object that I'm going to call gamma of phi expresses the system in terms of the response of the system to G, to the external field applied to the system. Okay, and well, it's something which is very much used in thermodynamics and in statistical mechanics. For instance, going from the free energy to the, you know, if you have a gas or system which is submitted to some pressure, or where you fix the volume, for instance, if you have a system, a gas, a perfect gas, which is in fixed volume, and you vary the volume, the response of the system in terms of energy is a pressure. If you vary the volume of a system, of a gas in a box, you vary the energy, and the variation is energy, is by definition, it's pressure, because the variation of an energy is a force. Okay. And so there is a, if you consider that the quantity of the system you study is the energy, and you vary the volume, if you study the system in terms of the pressure of the system, then what you have to consider is the enthalpy of the system. So the enthalpy is the Legendre transform of the energy of the system, etc., etc. So now let's go back to our quantum system, and let me state what is this somehow mysterious response of the system to the field. So let me define it. If I am a system which is coupled to G, so I have a system, my quantum system, with a source term. So I have a source term, G, which is different from zero. Okay, so the partition function of the system is this Z of G. Okay, then let me apply the property. I consider the functional derivative of W of G with respect to variation of the source term at a given point Z or X. Well, here I won't have any, okay, let me X to my notation. Well, that by definition, that's the expectation value of the field, the quantum field phi at a point X, but in the presence of the source term, because I have not set G equals zero here. So by definition, this is just, of course, integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi minus g times phi, okay, times phi of x, divided by integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi minus g dot phi. Okay? If you believe this theorem, for n equal 1, I have no h bar, this is 1. So at first order in G, W of G is integral dz, G of Z, expectation value of phi of Z. And therefore, I made the calculation, I found this. So this is the expectation value of phi when G is different from zero. So of course, if you take this derivative and set G equals zero at the end, you get the expectation value of phi of X, or the one-point function in the original theory. But here, that's the one-point function of the theory when the source term is on zero. One-point function. Okay? So of course, this is an expectation value of a quantum field. So it depends on X. So it's a classical field. So this object, let me rewrite it, this object, phi of X of G, let me define as a new phi of X. So this is a quantum field. This is a classical field because it's a function. I have an average over the fluctuation of 5x, but of course it depends on g. So we can rewrite it. So in fact, it's a phi of x and g. It's a functional of g. So it's a function of x, which is a functional of g. Okay? Because here g is non-zero. So g appears in the functional integral, both in the numerator and in the denominator. Therefore, it's going to be a complicated functional of g. So this object that I have defined in this way is called, this is called, so this object, which is defined here, this is called the background field. Okay. It's the average field when you average over the quantum fluctuation that the system produced as a response to G. It's a response D. Okay. Okay. So now, okay, let me erase this because I have repeated this. So I have defined what is a background field. So now we proceed in a standard way for Legendre transform argument. So this is a response to G. So this would be, for instance, the pressure when you take the derivative of the energy of the system with respect to the volume. So what is a Legendre transform? So now I've defined the background field. So now I'm defining the effective action gamma of phi. So gamma of phi is just the Legendre transform of W. So this is, by definition, G times phi, the background field, minus W of G. Okay. When I just where now I make a change of variable. Instead of considering that phi is a function of g, is a functional of g, I consider that G of phi is a functional of phi. So you see, the mapping, given a G for the theory, you get a phi. So given a function on space, you get another function of phi. But you can view this as just a change of variable, a change of coordinate in the space of function. So if instead of considering that phi is a functional of g, I consider that the source term g is a functional of phi, then if I consider that a function gamma of phi is g phi minus w of g, with g equal g of phi, then by definition, this defines the effective action. Okay, so this is the definition of the effective action. So of course, this is very formal. Because for instance, well, it's not at all clear that this is invertible. This mapping is invertible, going from phi of g into g of phi, it's not clear that it's an invertible mapping in this big space of functions. Okay. But we'll see that within perturbation theory, we can make sense out of this. So it's non-trivial. So this is a formal definition. But we see that it makes sense in perturbation theory. Because what we are going to show is that for a free theory, we can compute exactly this functional gamma of phi. And then in perturbation in powers of the Kubrick constant for the phi 4 theory, we can compute order by order gamma of phi. Yes?
Are we defining this dot in the same way as before?
Pardon?
Are we defining the dot in the same way before?
Yes, yes, that's what I'm going to say. We define similarly g of times phi is just integral d dx of g of x times phi of x. Yes. The same. The difference is that here phi is a random variable, where here var phi is a classical field. So, yes. I'm used to that because I'm trying to think in terms of tech and latex characters. So, but phi is phi. And phi is var phi in both in tech, LaTeX, but also if you go to the Greek alphabets, Wikipedia, you see that there are, or if you have been educated in. If you are an educated scholar and did classical Greek in high school, but I didn't, you see that there are different letters associated to different. In addition, there are different alphabets that have been used, I think, in different Greek cities in the classical times. And for instance, the Greek of, of Athens, Greek alphabet of Athens was not the same as the Greek alphabet of Lesbos, for instance, so that you can, when you see. You read plays by Sophocles. You don't. That's the same, not same alphabet that when you read poetry by Lesbos poets. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So this is phi. These are two different signs, but this is a field, a quantum field. This is a background classical field. So that's why that's one of the standard notation. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is there other or how do we choose the source J? Because
how are we sure that what?
You could choose in principle any function, right? To be J.
Yes, yes. No, I'm going to see. You mean any combination other than this one?
No, just the J, just the function J.
The function G, J. This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, J. Yes.
So,
yes.
Is there any preferential choice?
In fact, this one is the most natural, because phi is a natural quantum field. We are considering, you know, correlation function of phi. So it's natural to introduce a parameter which is conjugate to phi. So to any field phi, you can associate the source term. So of course, no. Your question is good. If you are interested in correlation function of phi squared, then of course you can add in the action a term with v2 phi squared, or if you are interested in this correlation function, you can associate a source term which is bilocal. Phi of x1, phi of x2. And that's done for some physical problem. So that's the first, you know, the simplest case of a Legendre transform. So I'll skip to that. I'll stay at that level. But you can work out more complicated Legendre transform, which give access to more physical quantities. Okay. So, so assume that we have been able to compute this object. So gamma of phi is defined by this combination of G and bar phi is a background field with this definition. So it is this definition, and let me recall, phi is phi of x is a delta W of G with respect to G of x. So it's a functional derivative with respect to G of the original function. Okay, so this is this and this. Okay, so this is the definition of the quantum effective action. Okay, so the quantum effect, well, this is Legendre transform, and this is the definition of a Legendre form of a function. So for any function of a parameter, of a variable here, G, you can define its Legendre transform by this definition. So it's a general definition of a Legendre transform. Okay. So, let me just, how much time do I have? Oh, I can. Let me write some. So why is this useful? Okay, let me. So I won't need that anymore. No. We shall see this effective action turns out to be is generating function for the irreducible correlation functions. In other words, if you want to, you know, manipulate and compute the contribution of irreducible part of Feynman diagram, a good way to study those is to compute the quantum effective action. It contains, it turns out that it contains all the irreducible correlation functions. Okay? So, I'm not going to prove that in full generality, that's a bit complicated, but I'm going to do a simple calculation in some simple example, and then try to convince you that it's a general strategy. The proof is not very, very difficult, but it takes a bit of time. But what you have to keep in mind in this, this object is important, not only because of the mass, but because it's the generating function for irreducible correlation functions. Okay. So, let me just state first two properties. Oh, maybe I can use that here. Wow. Okay. One important property, property one, the Legendre transformation, when it makes sense, is an involution. Legendre transform is an involution. What does it mean that it's an involution? It means simply that applying twice the Legendre transform, you get the original function. So this means that the Legendre transform of gamma of the background field is the generating function for the connected function. Of course, you can say, oh, that's obvious because I can just switch this and write W of G is phi times G minus gamma of phi, but that's not enough. You need to show that G of X is a functional derivative of the quantum effective action with respect to a variation of the background field at the point X. Okay? And it turns out that this is true. The non-trivial part is this one, you see? And this is correct because if you want to compute, let's compute. This turns out to be just a consequence of the change of of the rules of differentiation when you make change of variables. Here, you have a function g of phi. So take g of x defined by this definition and try to compute what is the functional derivative of g of x with respect to variation of the background field at a point y. Work just a little bit with this definition and this definition, and it turns out that this is just a Jacobian of a change of variable between phi and g. And here, we are making a change of variable from phi to g. So what you want to compare is just the Jacobians of phi of x with respect to g of y. Okay, so this is Jacobian of the change of variable from g to phi, and this is the Jacobian of the change of variable from phi to g. Well, it turns out that this is just the inverse of this. So my notation are not very good. I should rather think of this as so x. So let me write this as some matrix d phi of dg yx, and this by definition, this is dg of d phi xy. This is the Jacobian, the matrix element of a big Jacobian. This is a matrix element of a big Jacobian, and it turns out we know that this matrix is just the inverse of this matrix. So in other words, dg over d phi over d phi of y times d phi of y times dg of z integrated over y is just delta of x minus y minus z. It means that this is the inverse of this. And you don't need to compute exactly how this depends on the action, etc. That's the general rules of Jacobians. Associated to change of variable. And that's enough. This is enough to show this. Okay, so that's the first property. And this has an important consequence. Since g of x is the variation of the quantum effective action when you vary the background field, what happens if you set g equals 0? Remember, if you set g equals 0 here, you get the expectation value of the quantum field in the vacuum in the vacuum of the theory. So what is phi? So what is the expectation value of the field for the real, the true vacuum of the theory? This is just phi when g equals zero, because then the action, the original action is the original action. Okay? So this is phi when g equals zero. Well, we can put an x, but I'm okay. So this is phi when g equals zero. But now you can consider this from this point of view. When g equals zero, but when g equals zero, this means that the variation of gamma of the quantum effective action with respect to the background field, when you take its derivative with respect to phi, is equal to zero. You see, which means that phi for the true vacuum is just the value of the background field at an extremum of gamma of phi. Because then it's an extremum because its derivative with respect to phi vanishes for the value at any point. Because in fact, what I'm writing is that g of x is zero for all x means that this is zero. So, in order to compute what is the expectation value of the quantum field for your original theory, if you are able to compute the quantum effective action, and as a function of the background field is a function like that, you just have to look at its minimum. It turns out that it's the minimum because it has convexity properties. And the minimum tells you what is the expectation value of the field. Okay. So that's useful. That's in particular very useful when you have a quantum theory and you have to ask, it has a symmetry, and you ask, is the symmetry broken or is the symmetry unbroken? And if you compute, if you start from a theory like phi to the 4, which is invariant when you change phi into minus phi, you may ask, is phi equal zero, which means that the symmetry is unbroken, or is phi different from zero, which means that the symmetry is spontaneously broken. And of course, in a classical theory, you just have to look at the shape of the potential. But in quantum theory, quantum effect can change that. Okay, the question is that this is a non-trivial question because of quantum effects. Well, solution, if you are clever enough, you compute gamma of phi. This is phi, this is gamma, this is the origin. The symmetry is invariant, so the effective potential has to be symmetric. But either the effective potential gamma is like this and you are unbroken, or the effective potential is like that and you are in a broken symmetry. Okay, so that's one example where computing the effective potential is important, we see. Okay, so you have to keep in mind this. And that's it's a minimum. Okay. So, now I have only 5 minutes left, so I'm not very. But it's important to understand what's going on. So now let me just, okay, I think I'll just start. Let me show on the example of gamma. And I'm going to show that on the example of the 5-4 theory at first order. And in fact, I'm going to show something very important. I'm going to show that, in fact, a natural parameter of expansion, the natural expansion parameter, is not GE, but H bar. In fact, we have seen on the example of 5-4 that basically each time that you expand, make a perturbative expansion for a correlation function, you have factor G, there is a factor H bar that comes. So in fact, it's an expansion in G times H bar. In fact, it's better to think about perturbation theory as an expansion in power of H bar. So imagine that H bar is not, you know, it's a constant of nature, but since in our calculation, it's a parameter, we are free to change the value of H bar as well as we are free to change the value of Newton's constant when you are doing physics. But then, of course, you have to compare to experiments. Okay, and I'm going to show something. Well, let me just write the formula, and we are going to derive that tomorrow. Let me start from a theory whose action is S of phi, which is of the form 1/2 of d mu phi squared, plus some general potential V of phi, of course, ddx. What I'm going to show is that if I compute the quantum effective action, which is a functional of the background field var phi, if I consider that H bar is very small, so that my theory is classical, you can neglect quantum fluctuation, this is just the classical action, but evaluated for the background field Vi phi. And then, when you start to take into account the quantum fluctuations, to first order of H bar, you get a result which is very simple. It's 1/2. The trace, it's a log of a determinant, if you prefer. So let me write it. It's a log of the determinant of an operator. And this operator is just what we are going to call the second derivative of the classical action evaluated as phi. I'm going to, and then you have term of order H bar. And what is this object? This second derivative of the action is called the Hessian operator. So it's an operator. So it's an operator that acts on function. So it has a kernel that I'm going to call S phi of x1, x2. It's an integral kernel. So that when you apply this operator to a function phi, s dot of phi to some function f of x1 is just integral dx2 of the kernel, x1, x2, apply to the function f of x2. So this is just a function of x1. So kernel applied to function gives another function whose value of x1 is given by this integral kernel, this integration of a kernel. Okay, so it's a convolution of the function by the kernel of the operator. And S, the kernel, is the second derivative of the action. So what does it mean? It means that the kernel, which is the second derivative of the action, x1, is just the functional derivative of the action of phi, but the classical action, when you take a functional derivative with phi at point x1 and phi at point x2. Okay? So it's an operator. an operator whose kernel is this. And in this case of this theory, it's a classical calculation that I think you did already. What is this operator? The second derivative of d phi squared gives just you the operator minus Laplacian. So what is, in this case, the operator s second of phi is just minus the Laplacian, the Laplace operator, plus, when you take a derivative of a function v, a potential of a value of a function phi, phi, you get simply the function second derivative of phi. So this is the Laplacian. This is a function times the identity, if you prefer, identity. So this operator applied to function f is minus the Laplacian of the function plus the function multiplied, so if you want, s second of phi applied to function f at a point x1 is just the Laplacian with respect to x of f of x, so that's the Laplacian of the function, plus the second derivative of the potential for phi of x, which is a classical function, times f of x. So it's a function multiplied by a function, which is the second derivative of the potential taken at the value at the value of the background function var phi at a point x. So in general, this is something simple. So this is a very beautiful formula because it's general. Its value for any action, provided that phi is a bosonic field, basically spin zero or one, but in one you have gauge theories, which gauge symmetries, which makes things more complicated. So basically, if you have a spin which is spinless, this is valid. It's modified for fermions. And what I'm going tomorrow is that I'm going to show explicitly this formula, which is easy by using path integrals. I've not spoken about path integral anymore after this step. I just used formal properties of the Laplace of the Legendre transform. I'll go back to path integrals and functional integral to show this formula and to show what it means for the 543 and to show that this formula contains the irreducible diagram in a very simple way. Okay, so next comes tomorrow.